Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast brought to you by Huntworth. Huntworth gear for all types of weather, all types of terrain, all types of budgets. It's clothing that just works. Check them out at huntworthgear.com. And right now they have a 20% off site-wide sale for turkey season. So definitely go over there and save some money. This podcast is with Average Jack Archery, Nate Sellers, and he runs the bow shop, Average Jack Archery, over in Pennsylvania. He is a target shooter, a hunter, a YouTuber, and he's also the marketing or media guy for Huntworth. So that we talk about shooting on the big stage at Lancaster, shooting tournament 3D versus paper, how that affects guys going into this season now as we're starting to get ready for TAC, the Total Archery Challenge, as well as different equipment, different high-end bows, mid-range bows, owning a bow shop. And we talk about some of the new things that are out as far as like the micro adjustment, the tuning that guys can do at home, that sort of thing. So Nate's a great guy, great information, and it's a really good podcast. Got to give a shout out to our partners. We got a couple big things coming up here. Coming forward as we lead up to TAC. We'll get into those a little bit later on a couple other podcasts, but we are 1 week closer to our first giveaway of the season for the first quarter from great companies like Latitude, Big Shot Target, Spartan Forge, Lucky Buck, Canadian Zinger, Genesis 3D, and, you know, Latitude, they've got a bunch of new stuff coming out. They had just had their hats on 50% off. They've got their new knee pads are out. They've got a couple of big things coming that I don't think they're talking about yet, so I'll hold off on that. But you can use code BHC over there on their site to save 15%. You can save 10% with Big Shot Targets using code BCP, 25% off at Bowhunter using Bowhunter at SpartanForge.ai. And if you're not following along with them, the stuff that you can do on your desktop now there is incredible. And if you're one of the first, I think it was like 2000, which a lot of the our listeners were in on the first launch of Spartan Forge. There's a couple of betas that are being dropped that's actually using the AI that he tried, that Spartan Forge is kind of like built upon. He had to, you know, remake a mapping software to plug that into. But anyways, all that's coming down the pike. And then for our Patreons, Genesis 3D also has a code to save 20%. But you got to be a Patreon. So just get at me with that and I will get that over to you. But lots of giveaways from all those companies, including Flambeau. Their formula bow case is incredible. Alpine Innovations, got a few things from them. And got a couple other things coming down the pike. But anyways, this podcast is going to get you guys ready for, you know, if you haven't got your bow out yet, it's going to make you want to go shoot your bow, kind of start that process, get going with all that stuff. And check out Nate's YouTube over at Average Jack Archery. And as always, thanks for listening. All right, everybody, Adam back with another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast. And today we're talking to a guy who, you know, I had plenty of requests in the early days to bring on the podcast, and I was a little bit reluctant because it's just one of those things where you reach out to a random person B and say, hey, I have a podcast. You should be on it. And it's always a weird, like, first date type conversation there. And I watched some of the videos and very, very informational.
but lots of information. So it was one of those, like, you had to like sit down with a cup of coffee and a notepad and be like, okay, I got to get what this guy's laying down. And I had the pleasure of meeting Nate finally last year at the Mobile Hunters Expo. And it turns out in person, you don't have to have a cup of coffee with him. You can just joke around with him, and it's a good conversation. And so I'm really glad that we're getting to do this. So how are you doing today, Nate?
I'm doing great, man. It's cool. It's a roundabout way of saying, Nate, you're really good at being boring, which is totally fair. You know, English teachers, we are known for being dry. We're known for being kind of boring. But no, I do. I mean, it's cool to be on the podcast. Thanks for having me out, man. It was a blast getting to actually meet you, put a name to a face in Kalamazoo there at the Mobile Hunter Expo last year. Was that July? And so it was like, yeah, I got to have you on the podcast eventually. You know, here we are a couple months later. So yeah, it's been cool to be part of the YouTube scene, part of the podcast scene, being on with people and being able to meet great people and have cool conversations. And I'm looking forward to what we dive into today. So.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you see somebody on YouTube and you see the content that they put out, and you get like your own kind of like perceptions of like their personality or whatever, and like mannerisms and stuff like that. And then, you know, the first thing that Nate does is just starts joking like right off of the get go. And it's like, that's not what I expected at all. You know,
dad's joke. That's just who we are. Like we're so just doing the same thing over and over and over again. As soon as a dad gets another dad, it's jokes. It's time. We got to get out.
So, you know, you've let's talk about like your like hunting and maybe more so like your archery journey, because I feel like, you know, everybody has a, you know, whatever salt of the earth kind of, introduction to hunting, whether it's like, you know, being outdoors or it was my grandpa or whatever. But archery is like a whole nother thing, and most people don't take it down the road of like, all right, well, I'm gonna start my own shop now. You know, they enjoy, you know, there's the guys and, you know, having a shop, and we'll get into this, but they take their bow out, you know, 20 minutes before opening day, and they're like, it's probably still good. And they think it's a rifle. And then there's guys who, you know, have seven bows and all the sights, and they know every, you know, they grain match their fletchings and all that stuff. So like, how is your road into, kind of archery and all of that?
So to make a long story super short, I've always done some sort of competitive shooting. And I actually cut my teeth doing competitive firearms. I was a competitive air rifle and 22, we call small bore shooter. And, you know, of course, here in Pennsylvania, we're a lot like Michigan. You know, we do a lot of outdoor stuff, a lot of recreational archery, recreational shooting, hiking, camping, hunting, fishing, and whatnot. And so when I was 12 years old in the state of Pennsylvania at the time, you were allowed to start hunting. Now we have mentor stuff. You can hunt down to 5-6 years old. If you can pick up a weapon, you can hunt with a mentor license. But at the time I was 12, and I had shot a bow, just kind of a little wheel bow, you know, that every kid gets with the little fiberglass arrows and sticks into a hay bale and that type of stuff. And when I was 12, I started actually hunting with a bow for the first time. And Pennsylvania was 35-pound minimum, still is. I was barely making that. And I was shooting old aluminum arrows and old Bear Razorhead broadheads and Magnus Stinger Bees. And I never killed anything until I was 14 with a bow. But it was just that first 2 years of experience of going out, and it was 65 degrees out instead of freezing your butt off in gun season when it was minus 10 and sling sideways. And so everything from competitive firearms to competitive archery and then into bow hunting has really just kind of fueled the fire for where I am now, owning my own shop. You know, I work full time in the outdoor industry for Huntworth Camo. I go to all these big shoots around the Northeast. I get to travel around the Northeast and part of the Midwest to go bull hunting. So it's just been, you know, a culmination over the past 20 years of where I started when I was just a kid.
But in that, like, from that competitive side, because there's lots of guys that do, you know, that are into sports or whatever, that competitive shooting, like, how does it differentiate rifle or air rifle to archery? And then I guess, what are the parallels as well?
So, I mean, it was when I was shooting a competitive firearm, it's because I just kind of found out I was really good at my Red Ryder BB gun, you know, in the backyard. And there was a gentleman who was close to us that was like, Nate should go join the local 4-H club. You know, 4-H is a big thing across the upper Midwest and Northeast, obviously. And go join the 4-H club and see if you can join their firearm team. And so my dad took me, and we were in an old ROTC building on Penn State campus. I live about an hour from Penn State University right here in Central PA. And took it to the ROTC building, and I shot, and one of the coaches there was like, this kid, I didn't know what I was doing. I had no formal training. I just knew how to line up sights, how to breathe. I mean, I didn't know I knew how to breathe, but I just did all that sort of stuff. And the coach was like, this is something that he could be doing for a while. So I actually ended up competing at several state and national and international level tournaments from the time I was 12 to 14 years old. And what that kind of taught me was A, that just because you don't hit what you're aiming at doesn't mean you're a failure. It just means it's something to grow on, because competitive firearms and crossbows, you know, I can pick up the gun, you could pick up the gun, my daughter could pick up the gun, and that gun will always put wherever the crosshairs are at, right? And it's a huge learning curve then when people pick up a bow and they realize that their buddy's bow doesn't shoot this for them, or just because the pin was on doesn't mean you were lined up in your peep correctly. You weren't pulling the bow all the way back. Maybe you're torquing the grip a little bit. And so my small failures that I experienced while shooting firearms, then I was able to take those when I started shooting bows competitively. Because when I started shooting bows competitively, I sucked. I was terrible. You know, I was able to win stuff with firearms, but I never won anything until I was in college with a bow. And so I was grinding it out for like 7 years of just suck. But when you're grinding it out through 7 years of suck, and it's because of the 57 things that you're doing wrong, the face pressure, the kisser falling out of your peep, not pulling back all the way, grip pressure, wrong spine errors, whatever it may be, you're just learning. And it was, you know, starting off with a positive success with an air rifle or a small bore 22, and then being able to take, you know, understanding that I still have success in archery, but it's not as immediate. I just need to keep getting over those small little humps. I just grew to love the sport more and more and more. And it made the successes all the much sweeter. Whether that success was a really good shot in the backyard or actually winning my first tournament, it just made it so much more rewarding knowing how much time and effort I had to put in to make myself better compared to when I was just shooting firearms.
So from that angle and that, you know, 7 years of suck or whatever it was. I guess what was the biggest hurdle that you had to overcome or in that you see in shooters today that come through the shop or that you see that are coming up through competitive archery?
It's always about the mental game. Archery is 90%. The more I do this, archery is more and more 90% mental. And when I say mental, a lot of people think that means that's only what happens on the shot. Like you've already come to full draw, you already come to anchor, and that 90% is either squeeze or punch it, right? But realistically, it's 90% mental from the time you walk up to the shooting line, from the time you send your last arrow. All of that is 90% mental. So it's thinking about the constant repetition of, we do the same thing each and every single time is the same. So when I shot competitive firearms, if anybody listening or watching has ever seen like the biathlon firearm shooters compete or anybody in the Olympics of anything, they're wearing these like super stiff body suits. You know, it's really stiff cordura and leather. And the whole purpose of that is once you get locked into a particular position, it's very difficult for your body to get out of that position. And the reason being is once you're locked into a nice comfortable position and you're just pounding X's, you don't want to leave that position. Well, in archery, you're standing there in blue jeans and a t-shirt. You've got all the flexibility in the world. You have to be able to do stuff like that. And so it's what do you do mentally that is so repetitive? It's that stiff leather suit that firearm shooters have. What is that mental stiff leather suit that keeps you doing the same thing over and over and over again? So there are certain things like, you know, like actually, like I shoot a handheld style release. So when I clip my release onto the D-loop, where is the release in my fingers? Not like just feeling it, but like looking at it. It's a mental thing I check each and every single time. When I come back to full draw and I touch my face, my hand, thinking about that actual particular spot I'm touching each and every single time. It's just a constant mental game from beginning to end. It's not just the mental of, you know, actually squeezing the trigger. So I think that was the continual self-awareness you have is really what separates due to just pulling the bow out, you know, 2 weeks before season in August versus guys that are shooting year round, is the mental capacity to be aware of every single thing that they're doing every single time they pull their bow out of the case. And that I think really is what's that and constant practice is really what separates the cream from the crop.
So for myself, like right now, and I'll just give you an example is, so I'm working through target panic. I'm using a hinge. I'm messing around with the click and when it goes off and all that stuff. And what I find is that I can consciously get into like the first 10 shots. Like I can make the first 10 shots. It's like I have a clear head. I go in there, it clicks, and I'm like, okay, I've got my point of aim. And I'm like, okay, release pressure with my index finger. Like let the release creep. And then it goes off. But after about two rounds of five arrows, I get it there. And I don't know if it's fatigue or mental or if I'm like, okay, now I know that I can do it. So let's speed up the process and just make it go off there. And then next thing I know, I'm pass shooting, right? And so for guys like myself, like, and you talk about like that repetition and that shooting all the time and like, you know, does it just take 10 years of suck to overcome that? Or like, what are some things that help you when you like, let's say that, you know, we'll give an example of like, you're on the stage at Lancaster and I want to talk about that a little bit later, but you make a bad shot. With a rifle. And that's one thing, like when I was in the Marine Corps shooting, I didn't realize like exactly what you said. Like when I don't hit the target, it wasn't necessarily me. Like I was the guy that never adjusted my sights because I was on yesterday. Like I didn't adjust the windage two clicks. All my bullets were going in the exact same spot, but I was like, oh man, I must just be a terrible shooter. Right. So in that sense, like when you're on at the level you're at now, when you make a bad shot, like how do you do that mental reset and like kind of maybe, you know, to work me through like what's going through my head where I can do it for 10 shots, but then after that, everything goes to shit.
I think that, so we've all dealt with target panic, right? Target panic is the biggest thing. And a target panic can flower in a litany of different ways, but usually the biggest one is holding the pin on center. Like your brain panics when that pin's in the center and the bow's not going off. But target panic can also be in other ways of when you make a bad shot, it now causes panic that the next time you'll do the same thing again. And I will say that that is something I see a lot, you know, as a shop owner, the bow shop owner, I see a lot of new archers like, well, I didn't hit the center. Kids do this a lot. Well, I hit the center last time. Now I didn't hit the center this time. That's okay. Like Michael Jordan didn't make every free throw. Sure, he made a lot of them, but he didn't make every single one. He had to miss. What separated Michael Jordan from the rest of the NBA was A, he was a freak athlete, but B, his mental capacity to be like, okay, that was not a bad experience. That was a learning experience. And that's what happened to me at Lancaster. You know, we could start diving into this. So at Lancaster, this past year, I was shooting very well in qualifications. I was making super strong shots. I knew what was going on with my shot, and I shot very, very well. And then when I got eliminated the following morning, I made it through the first round. I got to the second round, and all I needed was a 10 to advance into the round of 8. But I knew exactly what happened. I made a soft shot. I'd come back to full draw. I wasn't pulling all. I mean, my pin was perfectly in the center. Everything was great. I squeezed to pull an arrow off, and I knew immediately because my hand basically stayed right here instead of having this big explosion like it usually does. Instead of go past my shoulder, it was right next to my ear still. And I knew I made a soft shot. Sure enough, I shot a 9 right down the bottom because I just didn't have all the draw length behind it. And instead of, you know, flipping out and snapping an arrow over my knee and crying about it all the way home, I said, that was a learning experience. That wasn't a negative experience. Sure, I got eliminated. And that archer, the other archer Rob ended up moving on, but it was a learning experience of, hey, if you want to get better at this next time you're here, remember not to do that. And I think that is something that has really been a weight lifted off me, a breath of fresh air. It's less about that was a negative thing. Oh, you know, we've all probably seen the targets on Instagram. The center said, you know, the center has like, do more of that. The next ring says, okay. And then outside, it's just like, you suck. And then outside of that's like, leave the range. So like, depending on where you hit it on the target. And it needs to be less like, you suck. It's like, hey, you did something. What did you do that was different? Or what did you do that felt uncomfortable? Or what did you do that you felt wrong? And try not to do it next time. And then the other thing too, I call it is controlled practice. And what I mean by that is you don't, with the exception of like actually like you're describing trying to shoot a whole bunch of arrows at once, like Lancaster's 60 arrows in a row, several hours worth of shooting. Sure, you do have to build stamina and you do have to overcome fatigue. But a lot of the time, if you get fatigued in the first dozen arrows and you're kind of new to the sport of archery or you're not used to competitive shooting, just stop. Just end it. Just be done. Because if you're tired, if you're fatigued, if you feel like you're rushing, all you're going to do is start ingraining bad habits or bad experiences. And you're not going to take them as learning experiences. You're going to take them as negative experiences. And all of a sudden, you're going to be like, well, I hate five spot, or I hate 3D, or I hate Vegas, or whatever target you're shooting at. And in reality, it's just because you just need to take a break and come back to it an hour later, if that's possible. So for me, it is just more or less understanding that we all struggle with our own demons, whether it's target panic, whether it's rushing the shot, whether it's punching the trigger, whatever it may be. And it's more or less understanding that we all have our own issues and how do we work through them, and taking those issues more as a learning experience more than just a negative experience.
But I feel like now, and there's a couple things in there. Like one, I was thinking as you said, okay, well, everybody's experienced target panic and this and that. Like I think John said it best, is he's like, I never had target panic until I heard what target panic was. And then it was like, oh, I'm caught. I caught the target panic. And then the other side of that is like, we all know, like, I mean, if you shot a compound bow for any period of time, and from like the moment that you've made one good shot, you're like, okay, all I need to do is line up these 19 things. And it will go exactly, because it's just mathematics, it's physics, it's geometry, right? But that little part in between your ears is what screws everything up. And that's the hardest thing, is because you say, okay, well, I just don't do that again, right? But we all know what to do. So how do you execute, how do you practice screwing up and recovering, right? If that's the easiest way to put it.
Well, so what I will tell myself is, if I'm doing something, let's say I'm in my range and I'm shooting a Vegas spot, so three arrows. Let's say I'm like, okay, I clearly didn't come to anchor. Let's just use anchor as an example, because I'm not a puncher. I'm squeezed the whole time kind of person. So I deal with pin float. So I just sit there and watch my pin dance as I'm squeezing a pole on the whole time, and it breaks in the middle. Let's say I come back to anchor and I touch my face and I put my hand at the wrong angle. And you know, I tilt it up more, I tilt it down more. The next time I do that, what I might do is not even shoot the bow. I do this not when I'm with other people on the line, but if I'm just by myself, either the backyard or my range, I will come back to full draw and I will just sit there and find the spot again. And then I will just aim the entire time, and then I will not shoot. I will let down, and then I will do it again, because our brain is wired to, as Ted Nugent says, the mystical flight of the arrow. We just want to see something. We want to see something fly. We want to see something die. We want to see something hit the center of the target. And to kind of, disreward, that's not a word, but to not give your brain that dopamine dump, sending that arrow down range and forcing it to be like, no, you're going to aim here. You're going to hold here. You're going to think about it. You're going to put your finger on the trigger correctly. You're going to hold it back here. Not allowing your brain to have that dopamine dump. If we send an arrow down range, where did it hit in the target? It curbs you real quick. At least in my experience of trying stuff like that, because you know what to do. And if your brain's like, no, we just want to send the arrow, we don't care if we know what we're doing. and you're just going to keep sending arrows. You're just going to keep sending, that's why I say take a break. Just stop. Just step away from the bow, because your brain will tell you send the arrow, punch it, go for it. Way more you can tell your brain, tell your body rather, to not move at all. So if you can tell your body to not move at all, you're just going to calm down. You're going to hold that pin as long as you can on target, and then you're just going to let it down. And then you let all the blood flow come back, shrug your shoulders a little bit, draw back and do the exact same thing again, and deliberately hold off on yourself, punish yourself, if you would, and not give that dopamine dump a send of the arrow, and see if, and then try to take a shot and see how it goes. And if it's crap, just walk away. Leave the gun, take the cannoli, as the Godfather, just walk away. And because you're going to create a habit right then and there that you're not going to be able to get out of very easily.
And now, I know we talked a little bit about it in, about like the big stage, but what was funny is like, you know, you were kind of like going live action, you know, on your stories and things like that when you were shooting Lancaster, and our buddy Travis was shooting right next to you, and it was like, oh my God, mm-hmm. You know, and then Travis ended up taking fourth, and I don't know where this all starts, but you know, John's like, oh, he took fourth. So he was like in the shoot off. So there's like a guy up there with a freaking microphone, like asking you questions and stuff like that. Like, have you been involved in something like that?
I have not made it to the Lancaster stage. This year I finished 10th. So I missed it by one round. If I had gotten through and gone to the next round, I would have possibly made it to the, yeah, I forgot about Travis there with you guys. Yeah, he made it to the round of final four. It was actually cool. I think all four dudes in the bow hunter class this year were all brand new to the stage. That hasn't happened in quite some time. And then Ethan Conway, who's like stinking 12 years old, won the whole daggum thing. But yeah, it was, it's something I've not experienced on that level of pressure. I've won other shoot downs before, more local shoots, much, much, much smaller than Lancaster. I've won the Great American Outdoor Show down in Harrisburg. I won that in 3D last year. But that's still, it's not that, sure, there's spectators, but there's not, you know, several dozens and dozens of people in the audience and then thousands at home on YouTube and television, you know, watching you. So I've never been in that much of a pressure cooker environment. One of our shooters that shoots in our shop, Kelly Weathersby, who makes Beeline bowstrings out of Tyrone, PA, he was in the senior open finals. And so we went and watched him, and just sitting in the dark off to the side, I'm like sweating for him. I'm not even on the stage. So I can only imagine the type of emotions you feel when you're actually up there. PJ's got a microphone in your face and you've got all the spotlight lit on you and music playing. Oh, I can't even imagine.
So take us through that, like the registration process, the shooting of a Lancaster. Like, is that the biggest one that you've done? Have you done Vegas or anything like that?
No, I don't go out to Vegas. Vegas is obviously the biggest indoor archery shoot in the world. Lancaster is the biggest second biggest in the United States, only to Vegas. Definitely biggest on the East Coast, and it's only a couple hours drive from my house. I love going to Lancaster. It's great. They have it at Spooky Nook Sports, which is a huge, just indoor, all things sports facility there. We don't even fill up half of it when we're there, and we've got like 2,500 archers are shooting, you know, all at once when we're there. So it's a huge facility. It's really nice. Of course, it's right there close to Lancaster and everything. So it's just a really accommodating part of Pennsylvania. If you're wanting to make the trip and you're not sure about it, do it. It is a wonderful place to go. It's a wonderful place to visit. It's not a hustling, bustling city. You know, you could park in the middle of the road and the buggy would have to go around you. You know, it's just, it's great. But in terms of Lancaster, just holds a phenomenal shoot. You register online. I think it opens up in like October, or shoots not until the following January. But you can start registering in October. You pick a line, there's multiple lines, and you literally show up, you tell them your name, lady prints out a thing right there. You get a swag bag with all sorts of stuff, but it's so clean and simple. They have two huge practice balls So where you, what you see on YouTube is not where we practice at all. That's just for scoring. So there's actually two separate halls that have big shot targets in them that you can go practice in as much as you want. You can, if you don't shoot till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you can show up at 6 o'clock in the morning and send 3,000 arrows down range. You can do whatever you want. So super awesome in terms of the ability to go do that and practice right there on site. And then, of course, the shooting, you know, a lot of people get very intimidated. You know, they see it on, if they've never been to Langstrom, never been to a big shoot like that. You're, I mean, you're elbow to eyebrow with people. I mean, you're right there and there's just a row of 175 archers. And on the other side of the hall is another row of 175 archers. And it freaks people out. And for me, I actually personally love it. I kind of like the... just you're another face in the crowd type feel. I don't know if it's kind of an anonymity thing, but you get to interact with the other people that are on your bale, people that are on bales next to you. There's four people on a bale at once. And it's kind of just a random who you're matched up with. So I had two guys shooting open, which is the long bars and lenses and all that sort of stuff. One of them was from England. So that was awesome to get to talk to a guy who flew across the pond to come shoot. There was a young female recurve shooter, Olympic recurve shooter. Her name was Sophia. And she came down from Canada with her dad. So like, you know, you got an open guy from the United States. You got an open guy from England. You got me, a bow hunter shooter, and a Canadian youth female recurve shooter all in one bale. And, you know, we're getting to talk to the wives and the dad of Sophia and all that sort of stuff. And it's just a really cool, like, where else are you going to do that? Like, I will never go to any other shoot but Lancaster and experience that kind of thing. So you shoot your 60 qualification arrows. It takes you like 4 hours to shoot 60 arrows because it's just all the scoring on the iPads and everything in between. But it's just a really good time and just good camaraderie. And then the next day is where the real pain starts. If you make the cutoff in your division, Bowhunter's top 32. If you make the cutoff in your division, you go and shoot starting in the bracket style. And in Bowhunter, they take the top four. Other divisions, they take the top eight. But yeah, it is if you're on the fence about doing it, particularly if you're going to shoot an amateur class, just do it. Just really just do it. It is just such a rewarding shoot, such a cool place. See that many archers in one spot, because you just don't get that very often.
And so break down a little bit that bow hunter class. What does that entail?
Yeah, so the main two male classes are open and bow hunter. And so open is anything you want to do. Big arrows, scopes with glass in them, long bars, whatever the heck you want to shoot. You could have an 8-foot stabilizer. There's no rules against it. Whereas in bow hunter, it's much more constricted. Your sight can have one pin or multiple pins, but it can't have any lens in it. So you can't magnify the target like you can in open class. And all of your stabilizers out the front bow have to be 12 inches or shorter. And that includes all the weights and quick disconnects. So you can still shoot a target bow. Like I shot a 38, Athens Vale 38. It was blue and white. That's still legal. But all my stabilizers had to be short. So I had a 12 inch system out the front and two 12 inch systems out the back with the V bar. Lancaster lets you shoot 27s, even though you are in bow hunter. Some other places restrict bow hunters to shoot 23s, which is what a hunting arrow diameter would be. So it's cool. I like shooting bow hunter a lot. I like, in our own shop here in Central PA, we have a bow hunter class for our league. We actually do classes for our indoor league here in Central PA. And so we get a lot of dudes that are just dudes are shooting a bow. I mean, they're just showing up. I mean, they're practically just unscrewing the prods and screwing field points in right before they go and shoot their score. I mean, they're just dudes who own a bow, multiple pin sight, index style trigger, and they're just happy to send an arrow down range. And so that's what the bow hunter class's roots are, the meat and potatoes are. At Lancaster, there was about 175-ish bow hunter shooters in our division. Men's open gets anywhere between 350 and 450. So there are definitely more open shooters than there are bow hunter, but it's a very stout competition. Bow hunter, it's still a lot of fun. I shot very well with it this year, and I don't think I'll shoot bow hunter again next year. I think it's time for me to move to open. But if you're looking to get into target archery, bow hunter is definitely a great place to start.
It's interesting. In the fact that you're like, okay, I want to move to open. Is it the, amateur class open or is it pro? Because, I mean, isn't open like where all the money is? So that's like saying like, yeah, I'd like to shoot against Kyle Douglas and Bodie Turner instead of like, you know, just regular dude.
Yeah. So, I mean, no, they do. So they do have. So bow hunter is always an amateur class. But then the biggest division is men's open, not men's open pro, just men's open. So these are amateur guys shooting open setups. And quite frankly, most of the time, that's just what a dude just shoots. Like that was his first introduction to target archery. My first introduction to target archery was the bow hunter class. So I've always shot that. It's not like the bow hunter class is inferior to the open class. You know, kind of cheat my own horn in it, but my qualification score this year with a bow hunter setup actually would have put me in the top cut for the open. Like I could have taken my bow hunter score, put it with the open guys at Lancaster and made cut. So it's not like bow hunter, shooters are underneath open. It just so happens that most of the guys that shoot target, they just skip right over bow hunter or they just go right in open. They want to try to get as accurate as possible, shoot all the bells and whistles as possible. But you know, then from there, there's the jump then to, and the same thing was true with women's. There's also women's open and then there's men's and women's open pro. And that's, you know, double the entrance fee, 2, 3, 4 times the money if you win. And that type of stuff. But yeah, there is a huge distinction between, and let me go shoot against Bodie Turner, Kyle Douglas, Jimmy Lutz, you know, Levi Morgan, Danny McCarthy, that type of stuff. So yeah, my jump to open would just be amateur men's open. I don't think I'm ready for pro just yet.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to, cause I was just like, oh,
maybe I am. Okay. And I just don't, I don't know my own potential yet. Maybe I am. I've always joked about it. I'm like, you know, if you're going to go and shoot the exact same thing, you know, and actually, the score that I shot, which was a 644, I actually would have almost made cut in men's open pro shooting a bow hunter. So it's like, well, maybe if I do jump to open, maybe I'll be right there. I doubt it. I highly doubt it. But, you know, maybe I will be right there. Maybe I will be paying all the extra money and getting my butt whooped in open pro, but I doubt it.
Well, I want to kind of circle back, but it all kind of ties into like equipment. You know, when you said, well, you know, I was, went and did my JROTC thingamajigger, and you said I'm really good with my Red Ryder BB gun. So, you know, you picture little Nate showing up to the air gun shoot with a Red Ryder, and then you've got the guys in the leather suits, and, you know, they got their pad laid out and all this stuff. With that in the competition realm, along with even just a hunting, from owning an archery shop and, you know, shooting against the, you know, bow hunter class, seeing all of the open shooters and being aware of that world and now, you know, considering the move over there, how much does equipment play in versus that little space between our ears versus practice, repetition and confidence, right? Like, so where does the equipment really take you to the next level?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I get asked that a bunch. And you and I have talked about this separately, you know, in personal conversations about, you know, a budget bow versus an expensive bow, you know, a flagship $1,200 versus a $500, $600 fully set up, you know, say like Bear Archery bow. You know, where is that line and where your floor and your ceiling, excuse me, your ceiling of your budget bow is at the floor of your target bow. Like, where is that? Does that exist? Or does it really come down to what's between the ears of the archer? And I will say that there is a point where you can't buy points. That there is a point where you can't buy points, right? You can buy the new Matthews title. You can buy their $500 bars, but that's not, you've reached your ceiling at some point. I don't know what your number may be in terms of, you know, let's just say you're a 290 shooter out of 300 on a Vegas phase. Are you really all of a sudden going to jump to 330X? Probably not. But there is a huge thing to be said about finding a bow style that fits the way you shoot and fits. That is a bigger thing with raising your floor than pushing your ceiling. So I know, for example, so I tried to shoot the Matthews TRX last year. Matthews TRX has won more medals with Levi and Danny and Chris Perkins, and now Kyle Douglas is on fire. And all of these pro level Matthews shooters are shooting Matthews TRX before the title came out and just slaying it, just laying it down everywhere. And I was shooting in Athens, my peak 38 time, and I was shooting it very well. And I was like, I want to see what this TRX hype is all about. Set up a TRX, went and shot it a bunch, and I could not shoot that thing at all. Like, I mean, I saw an immediate dip in 3D scores, which is what I was shooting for at the time. I was not consistent enough on target in the backyard. And I very quickly discovered that the style of target bow that I like to shoot, and this correlates to hunting bows too, has, you know, this type of cam system, this type of grip system, this type of texture on the riser. It doesn't have an overmoded grip. Are you shooting it right off the riser? Those things raise your floor. So, you know, my floor with the TRX was a lot lower in points score than it was with my peak. With my, let's just say if I was shooting a low 290s was my floor with my peak, my floor with that TRX was in the 280s easily. And so that means I was having these huge swings. I go from like a 288 to like a 297 to a 285 to a 297 or whatever. And when I would go to the peak, it was much more constant. It was much more stable. And so finding that bow style that works for you, regardless of price, is probably the number one factor that's going to lift your floor and push your ceiling in terms of what you're capable of doing on the indoor and 3D range. And if that style so happens to be a $500 bear bow, with the way the grip feels, the way the back wall feels, with the way the draw cycle is, and that is just the bow that shoots the best for you, then oh my gosh, you just won the lottery, because you don't need a $1,000 bow to shoot very well. But I will say that I don't think it has so much to do with the dollar value as much as it is actually not trying to put a square peg into a round hole, but find the bow system and grip style and cam style. Axle length is huge, that actually suits your shooting style and how you shoot it best.
And so how does a guy coming into your shop who has listened to all the podcasts, seen all the hype, you know, maybe watch some of this stuff on YouTube, come in and make that distinction because they've shot three bows in their lifetime, you know, and they don't know what they like, make that distinction in four shots out of, you know, the 10 bows that you got hanging in the shop?
So if a guy comes into my store, and if they've seen anything about me or they know anything about me, there's two questions I'm going to ask them first. Number one is, which bow do you want to shoot? And number two is, does that bow fit into your budget? Because there's nothing that I hate more than putting a bow in someone's hands that they cannot afford, or they should not be making a bad financial decision on, or they need to go home and save for a few more weeks, months, whatever that time it may be, and come back and purchase it. So it's always, what's your budget? Which bow do you want to shoot that fits within your budget? I will let anybody that walks into my store shoot any bow as much as they want. I don't care. You want to take it downstairs and practice with it for 30 minutes and put three dozen arrows through it, go for it, man. It's your money. You know, make an informed buying decision. So for me, you know, I'm in no hurry, no rush to sell someone a bow. But oftentimes, and particularly if they're brand new to the sport, or maybe they've come from some super old bow that has no relatableness to today's technology, is I will say, okay, we're going to stand right here at this bag that's right next to my bench, and I want you to draw this back, and I want you to tell me how the draw cycle feels. I just want you to focus on draw cycle. Okay, we draw the bow. Okay. Forget all about draw cycle. Now I want you just to focus on the grip. How does the grip feel? Okay, then we draw it a whole bunch. Okay, half screw. Okay. All right, now I want you to focus on how that string angle is, the triangle that string angle against your face. Does it feel really open? Does it feel really tight? And instead of saying, focus on this, and this, get one thing, just one thing to look at, one thing to focus on. Because your brain, oh yeah, I can handle one thing at a time. You know, my wife will tell you, I can't multitask. So, you know, I can focus on one thing at a time. And if you give that new archer something to focus on one thing at a time, usually they find something that they really like about that bow, or they just don't like it at all. And if you tell them you to focus on this one thing, usually it's either grip or draw cycle. Those are the one or the two things that they're like, I don't feel it. And then after that, you know, drawn a couple of times, then it comes down to the vibration of the bow. How does it sound to you? How does it feel to you? If it feels like it's something you're going to enjoy shooting, then don't buy it. If it sounds like it's really loud to you, then don't buy it, because you're just going to be like, you're going to always have it living in the back of your head. So it really is just giving it very focused, individualized attention to specific aspects of the bow, because one of them will jump out of you eventually. I get this all the time. Well, I don't know anything about bows. I never shot a bow before. I was like, you don't have to know anything about cars to know when a car sounds bad, right? You don't have to know anything about, you know, produce, like, or how, like, you know, how farmers, to know when an apple's gone bad. You don't have to know anything. It's squishy, it stinks, it's whatever. Same thing's true with the bow. You don't have to know anything about bows, but your body will tell you, I didn't like that thing. And if you focus that one thing onto the grip, the draw cycle, or whatever it may be, they're usually able to pick up on it very quickly.
And so for a guy that shot a lot of bows and, you know, deal with the setups and you know, everything that goes into getting a guy into a bow, what are the main differences that you're seeing from a lower tier bow to all of these flagship bows? And how much of it is hype and how much of it is real moving your floor, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question, because I get that all the time. Then, well, I really like this one and this one, but is this one going to be more balanced? Am I going to shoot better scores with this one? Okay, and you know, sometimes you just have to look at the person and say, no, you won't, because I don't know. I don't know. What I will say when it comes to the flagship bows versus, you know, I pick on Bear. Bear is a phenomenal bow brand. Make a lot of really awesome bows. I killed all my deer last year with the Bear Resurgence LD single cam. That thing was an absolute great shooter. Lots of great bows from Bear. You know, when you pick up a Bear bow, and I tell people this, they're like, what's the difference between the Bear? Why is it $500 and this Matthews or Bowtech or Athens or whatever is like $1,200? And what I, most of the time I have them do is I say, come over here. I have them stand at the end of my bow rack, which is open. I say, look down the Bear side. You'll see that every riser looks exactly the same. The cutouts are the same. The lengths are the same. Everything's exactly the same. I say, that's where your price comes in. They are normalizing and making it simple for production. What people don't understand is that it's not about cheapening the product. It's about simplifying the product and making it easier to machine, making it easier to produce, and making it easier to put in a box and ship out the door. You look at a Matthews riser, that thing looks like a cheese strainer, a spaghetti strainer, and like a Walmart bag all crinkled up all in a riser. It's insane the amount of machining time they have to have on that. So sure, you're getting a more polished product and a more quote unquote unique product with your flagship level bows. Maybe they have more color options. Maybe the cam is more skeletonized, so it's faster. Maybe they have some fancy tuning method on there, like Elite Set Technology, or Athens has the AccuTune on there, or Bowtech's Deadlock. Maybe you have something like that on there, and you don't get it on a budget bow, but that budget bow is quite often what a company ran as a flagship level cam style or a flagship level riser 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. I mean, Bear is running right now the Alaskan and the Alaskan XT or Paradigm is a Hoyt from like 2016. And the Hoyts of 2016 with that hybrid cam system was amazing. So why wouldn't it still be amazing in 2024? So it just doesn't have all the newfangled bells and whistles that Hoyt's come up with, or that Bowtech's come up with, or Athens has come up with. So those budget-minded bows, sure, are they as quiet or as vibration-free? No, it's not possible to make them that way, or they would be $1,200. But with your shooting a hunting arrow and you want a good quality-produced hunting bow, there's nothing wrong with it. And actually, I really have been trying to make a video where I take my budget Bear and I shoot a Vegas 300 round with it, and I take my $1,500, $1,600, $1,800 Athens setup and I shoot a 300 round with it and see what the scores are, and really actually kind of get that baseline of really how much difference is there between the equipment and how much is between the ears of the monkey behind the bow.
And so from that side, and we talked about this, I've got a whole thing about that that I would like to do as well. From that end, like, what do you think has been in that I guess just given your analogy there, in that 8-year time frame from 2016 to 2024 now, what have been the biggest innovations or the thing that's moved the needle the most in the technology in the archery world?
You've been able to see a lot of riser geometry is a big one, and it's subtle to the person who doesn't eat, sleep, and breathe the archery world. But when you add more mass to the riser, right, you obviously make the bow heavier, but then they're able to make the riser lighter but longer, which makes them stiffer, which makes the whole bow more vibration free, makes the limbs more parallel, which increases speed without having to increase draw weight. So the riser geometry and riser length has been a huge player. Matthews is a great example of this. If you go back to that 2016 timeframe, 2015 even, and look at the Z7. The Z7 was almost shaped like Pac-Man. The riser was huge, had a whole bunch of reflex to it. Nowadays, their risers are basically a broom handle. They're just straight up and down. And the reason being is they were able to figure out sheeting techniques to open up the bridging of the riser, make the riser lighter. They didn't need as much material. And then also makes the bow more stable and makes the limbs more parallel for more speed and for more vibration killing. So that was a huge part that has come about. Also, a second thing that's come around from a shop owner's perspective, and this is kind of a selfish thing, Matthew still isn't doing it, but the idea of rotating modules, which has allowed any bow tech on the planet to just pick up a bow, look at the module, loosen a couple of screws, rotate the thing to the person's draw length, and there you go. You know, for years, Hoyt, you had to be module specific. Matthews had to change out a whole cam. Prime, you had modules that you had to keep changing out. Elite, you had to put the bow on the daggum press to change out the modules on the thing. It was not okay up to about 2017. And then it has come to, we got rotating modules. Those rotating modules will have let off adjustment on it. Oh my gosh, you can do 70, 75, 80, 85, 90% let off on a cam. Quarter inch draw length adjustments, cable stops and limb stops. I mean, it has gone from, you know, this is kind of the bow as it is out of the box, and hopefully you can find it. If you need to sell it, you can find a module, to now that bow can see six different owners of six different heights and arm lengths and poundageness needs and be totally fine. So it has made the sport more accessible. It has made the bows more enjoyable with that riser geometry. And then there's also the tuning stuff. Bowtech's done great stuff with tuning. Athens done great stuff with tuning. Elite's done great stuff with tuning. But tuning to the end user is less important as the actual ease of use with the bow.
And that was what I was going to ask next, is about the tuning. Is like, does that make it more difficult for you as a shop owner, where you can set up a bow and then a guy goes home, watches a bunch of YouTube videos, messes around with all that stuff and brings it back in and says, I don't know what's going on? I mean, that's at least before there was a barrier of entry where they either like blew their bow up and brought it in, or, you know, they said, well, Nate, can you fix it?
That still happens quite a bit, actually. Not the blowing up part, but like guys are like, all right, I'm like, all right, you bought an Elite, you bought an Athens, you bought a Bowtech, you need two Allen keys. Go home, watch the videos. I got videos on my channel about it. Go home, do it. And they still come back like 3 days later, like, I can't figure it out. I'm like, all right, let's take it downstairs and paper tune it. Happens all the time. But what it has made it simpler, obviously, it's for the end user to try to, you know, not break stuff, but, you know, to try to tune stuff at home. But it makes it so much easier for me. If a bow does need shimmed, you know, that's not, you know, Matthews is still okay with the top hats, but like PSC or Athens old shims or Hoyt's old shim systems before they went with the normal spacers was a huge pain in the butt. I mean, just awful. Like five or six things on each side, they're all falling into the bow press, they're all over the floor, you're on your hands and knees, it's terrible. Now that's all been rectified for a lot of these companies. And so it has made the ease of use as a shop owner to be able to help people quicker. And then also, of course, for them at home as the end user, it just makes it more accessible for them if they really want to try something out of left field with an arrow setup, or go from a 3D arrow to a hunting arrow or vice versa.
And then maybe give us a hot take on like a couple of dark horse bows that aren't necessarily talked about, that are great bows that, you know, aren't the you know, the Matthews lift or the RX-8 or, you know, something along those lines. And I couldn't, I was just in a bow shop last week looking at the bows, and man, that RX-8, I know, I understand it's carbon, but man, $2,000. Like, I mean, you think that the lift is like the, you know, $1,300, $1,400, depending on, you know, riser length and all that stuff. And I was like, oh, well, let's check out this RX-8. And I was like, oh, geez.
Yeah. Yeah. The carbon bows have gotten super expensive. PC carbon, Levitate, the Hoy carbon. Yeah, it's the Bowtech carbon, the Elite carbon. They're very expensive. They're very good. The Elite Era is probably my favorite one. I think it's also the more economically priced. I think it's on the 17, 18 range.
Maybe, oh yeah. What a steal.
It's still very expensive. Yeah. It's better than paying 21, 22 for like PSC knock-on, Levitate. But, Dark Horse bows, man, there's a bunch of them. I have a real soft spot for Dark Horse things. You know, because I feel like anytime you can have a really high quality product that's a steal, that everybody else kind of just snubs their nose at, I'm like, yeah, let's do it. I would say I'll try to pick one from a couple companies. The Bear Paradigm, love that bow. Absolutely love the Bear Paradigm. If you want, it's the Alaskan or Alaskan XT, just with a bigger cam. So it goes out to 32 inches of draw length. I'm a 31 inch draw length. The Alaskan XT, the new one, doesn't fit me. But the Alaskan XT Bear Paradigm, however you want to shake it, that's a hybrid cam bow. That's what Hoyt ran for, gosh, 20 years on every single flagship bow they had. It's got bridge risers to it, so it reduces a lot of vibrations. 33 inches axle to axle, which is a little bit longer for just a straight up hunting bow, but it's really nice. You know, if you think about it, you know, the Matthews Lift 33 is probably the more popular between the two models in my store. So if that can be popular for them, it can be popular for Bear too. So a great crossover 3D indoor all-around bow, decent brace height on it, great speeds, great draw cycle, and it can either do a cable or a limb stock, which to see that amount of adjustment, you know, 45, 60 or 55, 70 pound weight range, like I said, like 26 and a half to 32 inches of draw length, something like that. To see that amount of adjustment in a bow that is retails under $650, I think fully kitted out, is nuts. That is absolutely nuts in today's world. And Bear comes with a warranty. They're made in Gainesville, Florida. Go Gators. And they usually have very good reps. You know, I love my rep here. Mike Scott reps us for Average Check Archery. And it's just a great Dark Horse bow. I really check that in the Alaskan XT out. If you want to go up in price point a little bit for Bear bow, really check out the Bowtech Carbon. Bowtech's had that carbon, not the Carbon One, but they're like their Carbon Zion, their Carbon, I think it's the Zion. I think it's what they still call it. We're not a Bowtech dealer, but they had that model of that solid riser, solid limb bow for 7 years now. So it clearly must be selling right. But usually it's a binary cam system. It's stupid lightweight. So all you backcountry guys, your out west guys, or guys who want to hunt out of ground blinds, or you've got a height deep on a public, it is a great bow. It is the most expensive. I think it's going to run you probably close to $700, if not a little bit more, just bare bow. But that bow is probably most, it doesn't have a whole lot of features to it, but your most just lightweight, taking a stab at the Matthews lift kind of to weight in a hunting bow that's affordable. A lot of great options with that one. Trying to think. I think those would be my two. Elite makes the Terrain and Ember Basin, which are all very solid platforms, but I would take the Bear over those just based on price point. But they're just really good stuff. Oh, that's what I wanted to say. For everybody that's looking to do the fancier systems, like your integrated stuff, like your integrated rest, your integrated sights, your integrated that type of stuff, you got to check out the QAD R2 and the IMS from Limb Driven Rest from Trophy Ridge. Those two rests come way in under the price point of the normal integrated stuff. The Bears offer an integrated system, Leets offer an integrated system, PSC. Those things are really good accessories that allow you to use all the integrated things without having to spend $250 or $300 on a stabilizer or something stupid like that. Definitely check those out.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because that I've been running that Carbon Zion for the last 3 years, I think. And before that, I had the Diamond Deploy, which is just the even more of a bastard child of that. You know, it's just the cheaper. It was the old Carbon Icon before they went to the binary cam. So it was like the original Carbon Icon, and then they just branded it for Diamond. And then I had a Carbon Knight as well. And same thing. It's just like a utilitarian bow. I mean, it's just simple for people anybody can work on. I'm not taking it to, you know, any dealers not going to look at that and be like, oh, we don't work on those here. It's like simple technology, easy bow.
Yep.
You know, it's been around forever, so people are familiar with the setup of it. Yeah, it's a bow that I really like. And I've literally beat the crap out of.
Yeah. And I'm not just saying, I knew you owned that boat. I'm not saying that because we're on the show. I'm, you know, it's truthfully, you know, that kind of bow or the Alaskan XT, those are probably your best options for taking a stab at your high dollar bows. Those are really the two that I've shot, that I have experience with, that are taking a stab at $1,000, $1,200 bow market that cost half as much. There are a boatload of other budget bows out there that are better priced than those, but they are not taking the same level of stab, in my opinion, at that $1,000 bow compared to what those two models are currently doing. And not because they're the same speed or whatever, but it's, again, I'm comparing that Carbon bow to the Lift, and I'm comparing that Alaskan XT to like what Hoyt does with their VTM 33, 34, that type of stuff. It's the exact same type of idea, just taking punches at it for 50% of the cost.
So real quick, what is the best tuning system that's out there that's integrated into the bow? So there's a few different companies that have it. Which one do you think is the most beneficial or easier to use, affords the most features or tunability?
So the three out there right now are the Elite with their set technology, Bowtech has their Deadlock technology, and then Athens this year introduced their AccuTune. So all of those are what I call shimless, pressless tuning technologies. So they allow you just with Allen keys to tune the limbs, to tune the KMs without having to press or any fancy tools or anything like that. I have owned multiple Elites in the past, starting with the Cure and the Result that had the set technology. And that stuff was great. That was awesome stuff. I've shot a bunch of Bowtechs, never owned one. I've done a lot of work on them, but that Deadlock technology is also really good. You know, loosening up an Allen key, that's a set screw, tune to the KMs right there in the axle, it's great. Then Athens this year came out with their own version of that kind of on the axle tuning kind of method. Bowtech is exterior to limb and uses a much smaller, it uses a 3/16 axle, whereas Athens uses a 1/4 inch axle. So it's a beefier integrated system. It's actually part of the limb on the inside. And it has all the witness marks and detents, so it actually clicks through and you actually can see exactly how far you've moved the cans, both top and bottom. So Elite doesn't have witness marks, like how much or where it's sitting. So for example, you know, if a person from the factory doesn't set it exactly the same when they put it in the box, and I've seen it on Elites that have come into the shop, sometimes you actually it's already cocked really goofy when it shows up to the store and you've got to reset it, or you forget to reset it. Customer tips, takes home an untuned bow. Bowtech system, I guess I never owned it, but people have been talking about how it's stripped out a couple of times, or maybe it just wasn't as robust as they thought it was. I have no experience with that, so I'm not going to pass judgment on it. But that Athens system, with having all the witness marks, the sight windows that are on it, so you can actually see exactly how far over you've moved it. And I think it's like 5/1000ths per click. I mean, it's nuts. That has been great. I've tuned now 3 or 4 bows with it. My Vale 38, which has it, that I got this year and shot at Lancaster, tuned it up with a 27, 23 and a standard diameter hunting arrow. No problems. If you're in the market for a high-end flagship bow that has that kind of quote-unquote shimless, pressless technology, definitely give the Athens Axis, which is their hunting line, or the Vale, a look. I think it's really worth the time and effort.
All right. Anything else on bows that you think is a valid addition to this conversation?
If you're looking to go shoot a bow, shoot them all. And I say that, I tell it to everybody, you can shoot every single thing that's on my wall. Don't make a decision about what you're going to buy before you go and buy it. You know, don't say, okay, I'm going to go buy Matthews and I'm going to go try it out first before I buy it. Well, you don't need to try it. Just buy it. If you've already made that decision, let the bow kind of pick you, you know, take the day of it and genuinely give it a shot. Because you might be surprised with yourself, what bow you're exactly going to go with. I see it every single day. Oh, I think I'm going to buy this, but I want to try this one out too. Okay. And then a lot of the times they go with the other one they wanted to try out too. So let the bow kind of work with you, pick it. Don't have a full premonition thought because it probably won't come true.
Okay. Well, I know you're going to have to get back to work. I've been doing my best to keep you out of work, but you want to talk about what it is you do now for a living?
Yeah. So I work for Huntworth Camo out of Pittsburgh, PA. So I'm a marketing media coordinator. I manage all of our pro staff. I do a lot of analytics behind the scenes, a lot of product development and you know, getting ready to launch new products and new things. And it's a really exciting opportunity. I left teaching back in August of 2023 to do this. And so I work for Huntworth full time. Neil and Karen are wonderful people. They've been in business for 20 years right there in the heart of Pittsburgh. You can literally throw a rock into the Ohio River from their facility there in downtown Pittsburgh. So it's as grassroots American dream as you could get. And I'm very, very proud and very honored to be a part of that and being able to be part of a family of brand that represents a lot of what Average Jack Archery is about and a lot of what I'm just about as a person. Just hard work, you know, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, make the money yourself and make high quality clothing and that people can afford and that people can actually enjoy and feel proud. And we're making two great patterns, as everybody knows. I mean, you're wearing Disruption right now. You know, actually, I think I have a Disruption vest behind me. Yeah, which is blurred out by the camera, but we make Tarnin as well. It's just really awesome gear that we take great pride in giving to our customers across the globe.
So let me turn the tables on you, and why don't you give me your elevator pitch on what does Huntworth mean? But before you do that, I just thought of something. Looking at your sweatshirt there with the Average Jack and being at ATA, and a bunch of people were like, "Oh yeah, that's Nate Sellers." Yeah, but I just call him Jack. I always call him Jack because he's Average Jack Archery. Like I didn't even know his name for the longest time. Like, where does Average Jack come from? Like, why is it Average Jack instead of Nate's Archery or something of that
date? Yeah, it's a super embarrassing story. But real quick, going back, I'll answer the phone in the shop all the time. Average Jack Archery, this is Nate, how can I help you? And I'll do that. And a guy will be like, "Hey Jack," like he just runs right past the fact that I said my name was Nate. Or I'll be like, "Average Jack Archery, how can I help you?" And they'll be like, "Hey, is this Jack? I need to talk to Jack." I'm like, "No, I am Jack." "Oh, okay." I said, "No, my name's Nate, though." But come on. So super embarrassing story-wise to Average Jack Archery. When I was in middle school, like a good little boy, we all were playing Xbox 360. And, you know, Battlefield and Call of Duty and that type of stuff. And so you got to go online and play with your friends. And I was terrible at the games. And I wanted my gamer tag to be an Average Joe, right? Because I'm just a terrible gamer. Well, of course, that was already taken. So was the next J name I thought of, an Average Jack. And sure enough, that gamer tag was not taken. And so since I've been like 14 years old, 13 years old, I've had an Average Jack as my Xbox gamer tag. I don't play anymore. But that stuck with me. So when I started the YouTube channel in 2014, I was like, well, Average Jack Archery, you know, let's just go with it. And it works out great. It works out great. So yeah, it came from a freaking Xbox 360 gamer tag. It's a true story.
Nice. So, you know, from your marketing genius side, your new livelihood, all of this stuff, you know, what, so your elevator pitch on guys who don't believe me, now they'll believe the marketing guy from Huntworth. What are the biggest attributes, or what is Huntworth in a nutshell?
What I say about Huntworth is that Huntworth is for every hunter and for every hunt. I don't care who you are, where you are, what your financial status in life is, you know, what kind of game species you're hunting. We make clothing for you on your level. And then it's for every hunt. So whether it's out of your back 40, you know, hunting a whitetail, whether you're on the game lands chasing turkeys, whether you're out in the mountains of Colorado chasing elk, we have gear for every hunter and for every hunt. Two great patterns, lightweight, midweight, heavyweight. Our heat boost technology is really innovating what warmth should be compared to bulk in a garment. Windproof, waterproof, you name it. We have it all. And, you know, we're doing it all with our mindset of, you know, we're born and raised in Pittsburgh, if you will, and the blue collar grassroots community that Pittsburgh is. And so understanding that, you know, we were kind of forged through that fire. A lot of the hunters out there are also forged through that fire. We don't all have six-figure jobs and live in giant mansions and drive fancy cars. You know, we really do have to watch our paycheck. We have a wife or husband and kids to feed and everything else. And we want to have that. You know, we're not interested so much in the bottom line, the bottom dollar, as much as we are making sure that those people that resonate with us the most have quality clothing they feel proud in, that they feel comfortable in, they feel warm in, they feel dry in. And that is a huge thing for us. So when, like I said, when we strive to make clothing, we make it for every hunter and for every hunt.
I'd agree with that. Like I say, I've beat the crap out of it. I'll just tell you right now. And
oh yeah, it's absolutely,
it's held up for me. So, and you know, I can't say enough good things about it, just from, you know, even from a consumer standpoint, like what I look for in clothing. And it's funny because it isn't necessarily the hype, you know, that you get from like Sitka or even First Light, you know, where it's kind of like shoved down your throat type stuff. And you know, that's why I'm happy to be able to kind of help get the word out on it. But yeah, it isn't like, oh yeah, it's $900. So you have to, that makes it good. That validates it. You know, kind of like the bow stuff, you know, same.
Oh yeah.
Same thing.
We're not interested in selling you $1,000 outfit. That's not jacket and pants. That's never going to be something that we're going to want to do. Because we know that at deep down inside, you don't want to be that person. There's a certain, you know, group of the hunting population that wants to be that person, that if it's the most expensive, therefore it must be the best. And that is just not the case. It's not the case. If that were the case, then we would all drive Mercedes, because they'd be the best cars for us to drive. But it's just not, I drive a Ford. It's just not the case. And so it's something that, like I said, we take great pride in and really getting customer feedback and community feedback on the garments that we provide. What are we working for to create next that's useful? You know, we had a lot of feedback on people wanted a heat boost hoodie. We were getting that from staffers. We were getting to the community. And we came out with the Grayling hoodie this year. And that thing is phenomenal. That thing is going to be on my body all turkey season. You know, right now we're in the middle of our turkey season sale right here in the middle of March. And that hoodie is a soft shell hoodie. It's got TR2 graphene fleece on the inside. It's super warm. It's great for insulation layer during deer season. But that thing's going to be on me all turkey season. We made a garment that you can now wear all year long that doesn't cost $300 for a hoodie. I mean, you know, what more could he ask for?
Yeah. And that, again, like when I pick up stuff, like the material on that is like extremely durable, but it's thick enough that it feels like it has like a wind protection. I mean, it feels like you're putting on something substantial. And I think that was the biggest takeaway that I had from that, like, piece of gear in particular.
Yeah, it doesn't have a windproof film in it, for just to make it very clear, but it has a soft shell exterior. So it's actually like a tight knit. It's a non-glossy tight knit sweatshirt. And then that's bonded to fleece. So you don't get, it's not a windproof film, but it has substance to it. You're exactly right. It's not like some jersey knit thing where the wind goes right through like a spaghetti strainer.
I can tell you've been working with the Huntworth gurus here in the last 6 months or so, because for the average Jack, they don't think of a windproof barrier and the coatings and all that stuff, but that's definitely how the staff at Huntworth speaks. Now,
oh, it's definitely, they speak it. They speak it. I live it. I'm the one dragging the sucker. they're like, you know, hey Nate, how does the 9622 and the soft shell exterior work out? And I'm like, you mean the Grayling hoodie? You know? just give me the hoodie. Just give me the name of it. But yeah, I got to pick up what they're putting down. But at the end of the day, I'm just a guy who tests hunting gear.
So
that really at the end of the day.
So we'll let you go here in just a second. But when you talk about the price point, like, you know, if somebody says that something is expensive, therefore it must be the best, from the bow side, do you think that you've seen that? Is that what's driving the prices up to $2,000 a bow? Because if you don't have $1,000 bow, I mean, hell, Bear now has $1,000 bow that I don't think that they have any business doing. But I think if you have $2,000 bows and then $600 or $700 bows, you know, it must not be good enough, right?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of it is definitely so. Here, I will say this. People think that the markup on bows is like the markup on clothing or the markup on cars. It's not. It is not. The markups in the archery industry are vomit. They are not good. It's why you see most shops that, or most shop owners across the country that are like me, have a full-time job and then they do the shop on the side, because the shop is not going to support them in today's economy. It's just not going to do it. And so the markup is really, it's not about, I don't know what they're producing them in the factory for. So maybe they're gouging us as they're shipping them out the factory, but I'm assuming not. So a lot of it has come down to the actual just cost of material. But then also, exactly to your point, you know, and I'll use Athens again as an example. Athens back in the day, when I say back in the day, I'm talking like in the mid-2000s, you know, 2012 to 2016 time frame. They were known as the flagship bow company that sold at $800. That was their, that was kind of their little niche of the market. We don't have that anymore, because now people have assimilated with, if you're in the $1,000 and over club, you're flagship, and anything underneath that is not flagship. And we've actually kind of grown out. The Elite Terrain is actually one bow, and the Carbon Zion, to an extent, if it wasn't so daggum light, would probably be in the same category. The Elite Terrain is a great bow, but I think it's like $750 fully loaded, almost $800 fully loaded. Well, people are like, well, why is it $800? What corners did you cut? Why didn't it make the cut to be a flagship level bow? It's clearly not cheap enough as your cheapest bow. Okay, I get that. So what is it missing that I could have if I just saved an extra $300, $400 and went with the flagship? So it's kind of, we've kind of, as a market and as a society, have gotten rid of that mid-price, that upper mid-tier bow, just based on the fact that we feel it's either this or it's this. It's very black and white. And I think that's not for the better of the archery industry. I really would love to see options from 400 to 1400 and everywhere else in between, because you're going to eventually start having the groups of people that can afford one or the other. Are they going to start pointing fingers at each other? And that's never good. That is never good for any industry, in particular the archery one.
Yeah. And like I said, it's just interesting, kind of like going back to everything that we were talking about. So, but yeah, this has been a really fun conversation. I don't know if you got as much out of it, considering I was bashing you right from the get-go. But
oh, man, I'm having a blast. I don't have 3 hours, but I'm having a blast.
But so where can people follow along with like what you're doing and like the shop, all of that stuff? And you're, I believe, one of the few shops that's open on Sundays in PA, right? So
we are not very much is going on in Pennsylvania on Sunday afternoon at 6. So we are open. You can't hunt, but you go to the bow shop. So yeah, you can find us Average Jack Archery on socials, Facebook, Instagram, so on and so forth. You can find us averagejackarchery.com. You can check us out there, get a hold of us. We do work for everybody. We do work all through Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, Ohio. People come from all over to the shop. We're right smack in the center part of the state, so right next to Penn State University. So, you know, we're in a decent mecca there of human beings. But yeah, you can always send me an email, averagejackarchery@gmail.com. If you got a question, you can follow me over in Huntworth on the social media there. I'm usually creeping and crawling around on the social platforms in one way or another throughout the week.
Awesome, Nate. Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.